Hello and welcome to the Iota Unum podcasts from the Latin Mass Society. In the company of some great friends of tradition from around the world, we will be drilling into some of the fundamental issues affecting us today in the church and the world.
I'm delighted to be able to present this book on the petitions to preserve the traditional Mass in Rome, the city in which these petitions were initiated by Cristina Campo, the founder of Una Voce Italy in 1966, in the centenary year of her birth, 1923. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to say some words about the book to this distinguished audience. My aspiration for this book is that it should place the petitions and the movement which organized them into a more complete context. The phenomenon is often reduced to the name of Agatha Christie, a signatory of the 1971 petition and the English indult which followed the presentation of this petition to Pope Paul VI. It is true, on the one hand, that Agatha Christie is the most successful fiction writer of all time. Wikipedia tells me that she has sold more than 2 billion copies of her books in 44 languages. And on the other hand, it is also true that the English indult, which allowed the bishops of England and Wales to permit celebrations of the traditional Mass, was an important milestone for the movement to preserve the Church's ancient liturgy. Nevertheless, the petitions are far more interesting and important than this implies, because we can see in the thinking of the signatories what we might call the traditional movement's intellectual hinterland, the varied influences that created it and the resources which we can continue to draw upon in defending it. The extraordinarily distinguished signatories, poets, composers, painters, writers, representatives of the worlds of politics and business, even members of high society, did not sign the petition on a whim. In many cases, it was the culmination of a lifetime of thinking and working in the world of ideas and culture to see the destruction of the Church's liturgical tradition as a terrible act of self-mutilation by the world's primary institution dedicated to spiritual values and the primary guardian, supposedly, of the finest achievements of human culture. This was expressed with vehemence by non-Catholics as well as Catholics, and above all by converts to the Catholic faith, those who had been drawn to the Church above, in many cases, precisely by the truths of faith expressed in her art, music, and liturgy. Thus, the Italian historian Massimo Pallottino remarked, "I endorsed the petition as a scholar of history who has been fighting on the front line for the defense of our artistic and cultural heritage for many years, so that one of the greatest living monuments in the Horatian sense of our civilization, that is, the liturgical traditions of our church, is not mindlessly and gratuitously destroyed. But I've also signed as a Catholic, not only and not so much because of the doubts raised by some of the theological ambiguities of the new rite of Mass, which they want to impose on everyone, but mainly because I am convinced that the threatened ban on the traditional Mass would be a blatant departure from the principle of universal openness and freedom in the external modes of worship sanctioned by the Second Vatican Council." End of Pallottino. Pallottino's words can be resolved into three, quote, closely entwined considerations that keep returning in the writings of the petitioners. First, the importance of the ancient Mass as art, which should be saved as Venice or the Mona Lisa should be saved. Second, the importance of the Mass on the spiritual level, as something that expresses spiritual realities and feeds the souls of those who attend it. Third, a rebellion against the sheer injustice of the prohibition of the ancient Mass. What I try to do in this volume, together with the many contributors whose work is included, is to fit as many as possible of the signatories into the context of their times and the intellectual and artistic movements of which they were members. Two prominent signatories were motivated by a profound respect for mysticism: Christina Campo's close friend and collaborator, Elemir Zola, and the English poet Kathleen Rayne. These would describe themselves as perennialists, followers of the Hermetic tradition found in Neoplatonism and the writings of St. Albert the Great, and which had a minor flowering in the early 20th century as part of a reaction against industrial and individualist modernity. Another group in England, which we might call the pre-Vatican II liberals, who regretted the anti-modernist purge of Pope Pius X, but did not wish this to be succeeded by an oppressive anti-intellectual and anti-artistic regime of liberal ecclesiastical mediocrities. Among these were many artists and scholars who signed the petitions led by Bernard Wall, whose Italian connections were crucial for the international organization of the 1971 petition. These ranged from the reactionary novelist Evelyn Waugh, who signed the 1966 petition, to the pacifist E.I. Watkin and the lapsed Catholic convert Graham Greene, who signed the 1971 petition. Overlapping with this intellectual circle were those who, particularly in England and France, were inspired by Viollet-le-Duc and John Ruskin and inherited the project of the restoration of all that was good in the art and culture of the Middle Ages, a project which critiqued not only classical architecture but unbridled capitalism. Among the signatories, there were also those who had embraced artistic modernism, not out of hatred of the past, but as a way to escape insincere bourgeois, mass-produced and sentimental art, to return to the perennial realities and even to spiritual truths. One example is the English poet Auden. Another is the Italian musician Dalla Piccola, the foremost proponent of the 12-tone technique. One prominent signatory, the convert English poet David Jones, baffles some critics with what one described as, and I quote, the apparent disjunction between the traditionalist content and the anti-traditionalist form of his poetry, unquote. It is interesting to see these figures joining in this project, alongside those who believed that the way out of the cultural crisis of the 1960s was a return to traditional cultural forms. Known to many signatories, though not signatories themselves, were the historian Christopher Dawson, who died too soon, and J.R.R. Tolkien, both of whom were strongly critical of the liturgical reform. Another petitioner was the Italian artist Giorgio de Chirico, who more or less invented surrealism and in 1909 repudiated it to spend the remainder of his life developing a classical oeuvre while teasing art critics and collectors by producing fakes of his own early work. Opposition to fascism is a final theme I wish to draw out. The first petition was suggested to Christina Campo by her friend Elena Croce, alongside the signatory Salvador Quasimodo, exiled anti... I beg your pardon, I've missed a line. Elena Croce, the daughter of the prominent artistic opponent of Mussolini, Benedetto Croce, alongside the signatory Salvador Quasimodo, exiled anti-Franco-Spaniards, the politician Salvador de Madariaga and the poet Georges Guillem, were also signatories, as was the anti-Nazi French writer François Mauriac and the remarkable Gianfranco Contini, a Dante scholar who involved himself in the partisan Republic of Ossola in 1944. Lanzo del Vasto was the most prominent of several pacifists who signed, a man who, like Christina Campo, was strongly influenced by Simone Weil. The involvement of these figures serves to remind us that Arif von Zaventem, first president of Univerge International, and the philosopher Dietrich von Hildebrand, who might be called the intellectual father of our movement, and he's already been quoted this morning, were both anti-Nazi Germans. Hildebrand had run an anti-Nazi newspaper from the temporary safety of Vienna and fled when the Germans annexed Austria. Zaventem defected to the British from the German embassy in Istanbul, where he was working, in 1944, having been implicated in the plot to assassinate Hitler. The German-speaking Alfred Murnau, a key organizer of the petition in England, similarly fled his native Czechoslovakia from the advancing Nazis. Bernard Wall, who I've already mentioned, visited Spain during the Civil War, and in his autobiography notes the atrocities committed by both sides of that conflict. He continues, and I quote from his autobiography, "It might seem from the earlier chapters of this book that I should have supported the anarcho-syndicalists in the Spanish Civil War. But for largely similar motives to the ones that drew many to anarcho-syndicalism, I was drawn to a party even more superbly Spanish and unrealist, the Carlists. The extreme romanticism of the Carlist movement appealed to Joseph Conrad when he wrote The Arrow of Gold. It was a popular movement among the peasants of Navarre, who demanded the restoration of ancient privileges, if not the resurrection of their long-dead king. Nothing less adapted to the conditions of genocide on which we were embarking could be imagined. The Carlists were what are nowadays called extreme reactionaries. But they were reactionaries in the sense which Eric Gill, with his ideals of withdrawing from modern industrial society, was reactionary. To me, the Carlists represented the last gasp of a peasant society, proud of its traditions, against the uprooted men who wanted to impose the values of modern industrial cities," unquote. And he's writing in 1969. Wall is correct to identify the appeal of fascism even more than that of communism to uprooted men. People who, thanks to rapid industrialization, urbanization, and social and technological change, have lost touch with their authentic culture. And that network, represented by traditional social and political communities, which might have given their lives meaning and provided a mechanism through which their wrongs might be redressed. The problem has not gone away, but what time has proved since Wall's day is that the traditional mass is not just an expression and repository for traditional values, but something with the power to rekindle their embers, even in the hearts of uprooted men. I should take the opportunity to say something about the place of non-Catholics and non-Christians among the petitioners. Bernard Wald refers to them shortly after the petition was published in a letter to the Catholic press. Here's another quotation from him. "The point of view of the signatories of the international appeal for the retention of the traditional mass varied from cultural interests to mystical ones. Far more Roman Catholic laymen were prepared to sign the appeal than could possibly be included in such a busy newspaper as the Times. Some literary and artistic signatories viewed a prohibition of the old mass rather, say, as one views pollution in cities or the destruction of landscapes. Roman Catholic signatories felt that both their spiritual and cultural lives were being destroyed. They were not protesting against the various kinds of new masses put forward during the last 10 years. They were protesting against a prohibition of the old mass. They felt that the prohibition would weaken both culture and religion at a time when they were desperately needed. They welcomed the support of their Anglican, Orthodox, Jewish, and agnostic brothers and sisters who, living in a plural society like them, felt that a liberal and plural approach to church ceremonies was in harmony with our age, when all are allowed to do and think what suits them best, and that a totalitarian prohibition of the old mass involved an out-of-date approach." End of quotation. Just as the voices of non-Catholics, like Marcel Proust, was critical in saving France's cathedrals from secularization in the Third Republic. So non-Catholics, a powerful witness to the importance of the traditional Mass in 1966 and 1971, was critical to the granting of the first indult to allow it to continue. Cristina Campo was explicit in seeking out non-Catholics in 1966 in a letter to a friend, Alexandra Prizanic. She wrote, only half joking, quote, the fewer the Catholics there are, the better, unquote. In fact, many important Catholics were included, but both the 1966 and 1971 petitions and many of their later ones, which are also covered in the book, emphasize the significance of their non-Catholic signatories. One possible response to the intervention of non-believers made in 1966 by the Italian liberal Catholic Adriana Zari was that the petition was undermined by being signed by what she called aesthetes and esotericists, rather than, I quote, balanced theologians and pastors, unquote. I addressed the question of aestheticism in the book in chapter 16. The signatories were not people intent on titillating a jaded, decadent aestheticism by attending services like Oscar Wilde's character, Dorian Gray, who I discuss in that chapter. Rather, they were men and women of cultural sensitivity for whom attendance of Mass was an occasional social duty in the context of the weddings and funerals of Catholic acquaintances, and who perceived in it something of profound cultural and spiritual importance. As I note in chapter 13 in the English context, the liturgy which Archbishop Annibale Bognini apparently regarded as an obstacle to unity with non-Catholic Christians was actually appreciated by them as something unique, magnificent, and spiritual. This insight of theirs may be incomplete from a Catholic point of view, but it is not in conflict with the attitude of the believing participant in the petitions. On the contrary, it respects and admires the Catholic attitude, and sometimes, indeed, develops into it. To give a sense of how the book is structured, several chapters are dedicated to exploring the intellectual and cultural currents which led so many great writers, musicians, and artists, whether Catholic or not, adding their names to the petitions. There is the role of Catholic converts, and in general, the laity, chapter 15, the program of restoration, already alluded to, chapter 18, the attitude of artistic modernists, including the Catholic poet David Jones, chapters 19 and 22, the view of perennialists, chapter 20, the reaction against fascist culture, chapter 21, and the background of a number of petitioners in distributivism and similar movements of thought, chapter 13. Important influences on the petitioners are examined, such as Pope Pius V, chapter 1, Joseph de Maistre, chapter 2, and Proust, chapter 3. I have discussed or included samples of the writings contemporary to the petitioners of Tito Cassini, chapter 4, Father Brian Houghton, chapter 5, and Christopher Sykes and Evelyn Waugh in chapter 7. In chapters 8 to 12, we enter into the heart of the intellectual circles of the key figures. Of the Italians, Cristina Campo and her friend Elemir Zolla. In chapter 9, of the Englishman, Bernard Wall, at chapter 10, and the British-based Czech-Hungarian poet, Alfred Murnau, chapter 13. Murnau has no biography or autobiography, but I have included some material concerning him. We have also been able to explore particular groups of petitioners, such as the musicians, chapter 23, and the later French petitioners, chapter 15. Only one of the early petitioners is still alive at the time of writing, the pianist and conductor Vladimir Ashkenazy, who signed the 1971 petition and very graciously accepted the De Cervantes Medal from the Una Voce International Federation on its 50th anniversary. His letter of acceptance is included as an appendix in this volume. The preservation of the ancient Mass continues to concern men and women of culture, as is indicated by the later petitions of the 1990s. Sir James Macmillan, one of the foremost composers of his generation and the signatory of the 2007 petition, is also a patron of the Latin Mass Society. In a similar category is Martin Moserbach, a major literary figure in Germany, who graciously agreed to write a preface to this volume, and Natalia San Martín Fenarola, whose 2015 novel, The Awakening of Miss Prim, indirectly concerns itself with the place of the ancient liturgy in the life and culture of the Church. One of the key organisers of the petition, Campo, Zola, Wall, and Marnau, I was privileged to meet only the last named as a youth. He was a family friend. His character is well captured by the two obituaries that form part of Chapter 8, and in a certain way he could stand for the whole movement that he facilitated to understand the issues, to care about them, and to act. The petitioners, and particularly the organisers of petitions, had to possess Marnau's paradoxical traits. A deep engagement in the world of art and culture, including in its modernist forms. A profound sensitivity to the importance of tradition. An outstanding generosity of spirit and intransigence. As the Order of Malta obituarist described Marnau, and I quote, "A reactionary Tory and a revolutionary radical rolled into one. He was incapable of half measures and felt and expressed with equal vehemence his love of beauty and his hatred of all that is stupid, inhuman, or bureaucratic." If this volume could achieve one thing, I would like it to imprint the spirit of the early petition organisers in the minds of a wider public, in place of whatever stereotype of the supporter of the traditional Mass might hitherto have dwelt there.